It is Monday, June 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, church services resume where 9 were killed last week. VOA's Amanda Scott takes us there.
When the pastor spoke and when other congregants spoke, they wanted to reflect on the beauty of their lives and not just dwell on the pain of their loss.
Also ahead, tensions in Somalia, river blindness in Nigeria, and the results of the U.S. Open final round. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Here in the U.S., worshipers returned to a South Carolina church on Sunday for the first service since a white man gunned down a Bible study group at the historic African-American church last week. With a thundering voice, visiting minister Reverend Norvell Goff stood for the slain pastor of Emmanuel AME Church, fondly known as Mother Emmanuel, in the city of Charleston.
The doors of Mother Emmanuel is open on this Sunday. Yes. It sends a message to every demon in hell and on earth.
Clementa Pinkney was the pastor he stood in for. He was among the 9 killed on Wednesday in what police are investigating as a hate crime. Goff implored the crowd of hundreds to rely on God as they grieve. VOA's Amanda Scott is in Charleston, where she attended the services at Emmanuel AME and told my colleague Jim Stevenson late Sunday it was a beautiful service of solidarity.
You could see people consoling each other, particularly the members of the congregation who are still dealing with the loss. But overall, you know, just from the sermons and just from the songs, it was definitely uplifting. And they wanted to lift the mood and lift the spirits and show their appreciation for the city as a whole, for how they've come together amidst this tragedy.
And quite a crowd. I understand the church was definitely packed today.
It definitely was. People came, you know, an hour and a half early before service started just to get a space. The church has 2 levels. There's a balcony in the lower level. I'd say they could easily seat a couple of hundred people, and just about every seat was taken.
Was there any sort of security presence for the service today?
There was actually a pretty massive security presence. From inside the sanctuary, I counted 7 police officers. There were about 6 on the lower level, and from what I could see, 1 on the upper level, but there was possibly 1 above me that I couldn't see. So between 7 and 8 police officers inside the church. Outside the church, there was security when you came in. All the women had to open up their bags and do a random bag check. So there were about, I'd say, 6 police outside the church as well.
The tragedy, of course, is going to linger among the congregation for quite some time, despite an uplifting service. It's going to take a while for them to heal. What were some of the comments that you heard as you were inside the church?
Definitely when the pastor spoke and when other congregants spoke, they wanted to reflect on the beauty of their lives and not just dwell on the pain of their loss. After the service, I actually spoke to some of the church members who, you know, reflected similar thoughts of them being in heaven and still being a part of them and their community. And just, you know, it's more of a positive acceptance of what happened.
That is VOA's Amanda Scott in Charleston, South Carolina, speaking with my colleague, Jim Stevenson. What happened last Wednesday night was a weekly Bible study attended by a local man, 21-year-old Dylan Roof, who allegedly killed 9 people there and wounded 3 others. With the help of some of Goff's friends and family, authorities were able to arrest him. He has been charged with the murders, also facing charges of criminal possession of a firearm. This latest horrific act of gun violence is forcing Washington to wrestle anew with the easy availability of deadly weapons in a nation that constitutionally protects the right to bear arms. VOA's Michael Bowman reports now the shooting rampage in Charleston has reignited a national debate on gun control that so far gun rights advocates have been winning.
Amid grief in Charleston expressed by the city's mayor,
we all have one thing in common. Our hearts are broken.
Reports that suspected shooter Dylan Roof, by all accounts a troubled young man, was given a gun as a birthday present earlier this year. President Barack Obama says America has a problem it must confront.
Every country has violent, hateful, or mentally unstable people. What's different is not every country is awash with easily accessible guns. And so I refuse to act as if this is the new normal.
Already, the issue is reverberating in next year's presidential race. Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton noted the Charleston tragedy followed shooting rampages at a Connecticut elementary school and a Colorado movie theater.
We have to face hard truths about race, violence, guns, and division. How many innocent people in our country, from little children to church members to movie theater attendees, how many people do we need to see cut down before we act?
America's biggest gun rights lobby, the National Rifle Association, has not shied from the fight. Wayne LaPierre heads the group.
We will elect our next great president of the United States of America, and it will not be Hillary Rodham Clinton.
The NRA's political clout is such that prominent Republicans lined up to address its annual national convention this year, including former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who is now running for president.
I have a message for the Obama administration. Why don't you focus more on keeping weapons out of the hands of Islamic terrorists and less on keeping weapons out of the hands of law-abiding Americans?
The U.S. Constitution's Bill of Rights affirms the right to bear arms, and the United States has almost as many privately owned guns as citizens. 2 years ago, the Senate tried and failed to pass legislation to better scrutinize gun buyers. President Obama says such measures are politically perilous, but will be embraced one day.
I know today's politics makes it less likely that we see any sort of serious gun safety legislation. I want to be clear, I am not resigned. I have faith we will eventually do the right thing.
Charleston was the latest outburst of gun violence in America. Few, if any, think it will be the last. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
And for more on what's being said about gun control, VOA's Michael Lippin joins us now for a look at the word on social media. Well, Michael, what are people saying?
Thanks, Steve. Well, the debate about gun violence in America has definitely intensified on social media since last week's attack on the church. On Twitter, I've seen two hashtags get a lot of usage by the people engaging in that debate. One is hashtag GunSense, and the other is hashtag GunControl. As for what people are saying with those hashtags, it's kind of a mixed bag. One gun control advocate whose tweet got a lot of exposure is American actor and political commentator John Fugelsang, who has 141,000 Twitter followers. He tweeted a photo of himself superimposed with a quote about the National Rifle Association, the main group supporting the right to bear arms in the United States. Fugelsang's quote reads, "The NRA reminds you that all these massacres are due to mentally ill people who should still always have easy access to guns." Now, the NRA doesn't actually say the mentally ill should have easy access to guns, but it has lobbied Congress against tighter restrictions on who can buy guns, saying lawmakers should focus more on solving problems in healthcare for mentally ill people. Well, gun rights advocates also have been active on Twitter today. One whose tweet became quite popular calls herself Cat Loves Country. She has 91,000 followers on Twitter and uses the handle Trucks Horses Dog. That user tweeted a photo of director and actor Quentin Tarantino superimposed with a line of text saying, "Hollywood liberals make a fortune glorifying violence and making violence look acceptable, and then blame conservatives for guns." So that's a flavor of the debate happening on Twitter right now.
And Michael, what about the feedback that we've been getting on the social media, for other aspects of our Charleston coverage?
Well, one article that's getting feedback is Amanda Scott's report on Charleston, which is leading our website right now. That report is titled, "After Shooting, Charleston Church Reopens." Well, I'd like to encourage our listeners to check it out, just like I did recently, because the article also has some nice video clips of the scenes inside and outside the Mother Emmanuel AME Church. I noticed that a Twitter user with the handle WiserInTime tweeted a link to the article, along with a message that read, "Look at the beautiful people of the South Carolina AME Church, blacks and whites united in peaceful demonstrations." Well, Amanda's tweet of a photo from inside the church during Sunday's service also got attention. A Twitter account for the Church Security Institute replied to her tweet by saying, "May God's love, peace, comfort, and strength be with the Emmanuel AME families, friends, members, and city as they worship and grieve." Well, if you'd like to tweet to Amanda, you can find her at Amanda Scott News. That's all one word. Steve?
Many thanks, Michael. That's VOA's Michael Lippin. A reminder, we have a new Twitter site for VOA's International Edition. Check us out. Our Twitter handle at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct.
And adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America. Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition. In the news, Sunday in Somalia, at least three Al-Shabaab militants were killed. It happened during an assault on National Intelligence Training Base in the capital of Mogadishu. The militants set off a car bomb outside the base before launching their raid. Internal Security Agency spokesman Mohammed Yusuf said Somali forces were aware in advance of the planned attack and managed to block it. The Al-Qaeda-linked group later claimed responsibility. Although the group has lost some territory since the start of a joint Somali-African Union military offensive, it has shown the ability to launch such attacks on both civilian and military targets. Pope Francis said Sunday the plight of migrants seeking to escape war and poverty in North Africa and the Middle East brings tears to his eyes.
Tante persone si sono impoverite e hanno problemi con la casa, la salute.
Speaking to a group of laborers in the Italian city of Turin, the Pope said the migrants, most of them from the Middle East and Africa, should not be blamed, calling them victims of inequality and war. His comments came as European Union ministers discuss who is to take care of the 100,000 refugees who have arrived on European shores via Italy since January. Nearly 740 more migrants arrived by boat in Calabria in southern Italy on Sunday. United States has welcomed Saturday's signing of the Accord for Peace and Reconciliation in Mali. A U.S. spokesman said Washington commends the parties for their commitment to compromise and resolving their differences through dialogue. French Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian travels Monday, later today, to Mali's capital, Bamako, to, in his words, see for himself that a peace accord reached between the government and the separatist northern Tuareg rebels is correctly put into place. French troops invaded Mali in early 2013 to rout out the Islamic extremists from the north. Saturday, Mali's main Tuareg coalition signed that agreement with the government more than a month after other armed groups did the same thing following months of talks in Algeria. It reportedly calls for creation of elected regional assemblies but stopped short of autonomy or federalism for northern Mali. Among concessions agreed to, rebel fighters will be integrated into local security forces. United Nations has appointed a Senegalese diplomat to try to bring together rival factions in Burundi in a bid to end that country's political crisis. Abdoulaye Bathily, who is already the UN Special Representative for Central Africa, was to arrive in the capital, Bujumbura, Sunday to begin his work. East African country has been in turmoil since April when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term. Speaking of spreading violent street protests, rights groups were out Friday, claimed that more than 70 lives resulted in 1,000 arrests, forced tens of thousands to flee to other countries. Government spokesman is quoted as welcoming the UN initiative, but said it would not interrupt the election timetable of parliamentary elections June 29th and the presidential balloting on July the 15th. Activists in Nigeria are mounting a campaign to get the country's National Assembly to open its books and explain how it spends its money. Campaign is already getting some results. Chris Stein reporting now from VOA's regional bureau in Dakar.
As the 109 senators and 360 House representatives of Nigeria's 8th National Assembly got down to business this month, they did so under the watchful eye of Olusegun Onagbindi, lead partner of nonprofit Budget. The group is campaigning for greater transparency in how lawmakers spend their $577.5 million yearly budget. Through social media, the courts, and meeting with lawmakers, Onagbindi says he hopes to cut through some of the secrecy.
There is so much speculation today. This is how much National Assembly has. Nobody can give you a factual figure unless something that is speculated. And this question is, let us know the allowances. Let us know how much is spent in managing the office and the rest.
He says the body has spent about $3 billion in the past 4 years, but refuses to say what it's done with the money, so he's suing to find out. Nigeria recently underwent a seismic political shift. In this year's elections, the opposition All Progressives Congress, or APC, triumphed over the People's Democratic Party, or PDP, which has controlled the presidency in the National Assembly since 1999. Now the PDP is in opposition, and the APC controls the presidency and both houses. Onagbindi says he hopes to take advantage of the new blood in the National Assembly and across Nigeria's power structure to press for transparency.
It's a movement going day by day. We need a National Assembly that is open and also demand something from all agencies of government.
The campaign is underway on social media. On Twitter, Nigerians use the hashtag OpenNAS to question how the new lawmakers are spending money. Social media entrepreneur Jafet Omajua has been tweeting about the campaign to his 230,000 or so followers. He says he's long pushed for more transparency from the assembly, angered by what he says are lavish salaries in a country where millions live in poverty.
Tell us exactly who's getting what, how much are your aides and assistants getting, how much are you spending on maintenance of your offices. You know, common sense stuff.
He's hopeful that with a new government in power, he might finally get answers.
A huge chunk of the lawmakers are fresh, so they should be in a position to want to do things differently.
The campaign has already gained traction, at least on Twitter. Senate President Bukola Saraki has tweeted using the OpenNAS hashtag in the opening weeks of the legislature, saying details of lawmaker allowances would be made public. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
U.S.-based Carter Center has announced that it's expanding its river blindness elimination program in Nigeria. Announcement was made at a recent press conference in Atlanta held by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter and Nigerian businessman and philanthropist Sir Emeka Ofor. They said the expansion will boost efforts to eliminate the disease in Africa. River blindness is one of the world's leading causes of preventable blindness. It is a parasitic infection that causes intense itching, skin discoloration, and rashes. In addition to its socioeconomic impact, the disease greatly reduces a person's abilities to learn and to work. It's being spread by bites from infected black flies that breed in the rapidly flowing rivers. In Nigeria, river blindness is endemic in nearly all of the country's states. President Carter said the Carter Center has been working worldwide to eliminate river blindness, and with Ofor's help, it will have great success in Nigeria.
Well, Sir Emeka has been already deeply involved in his own home state of Anambra. He knows the problem there, and I think with his endorsement of this program and his financing of a large portion of it, I don't think there'll be nearly as much problem as the Carter Center has had in the past. A lot of our problems in reaching out to the local people be resolved by Sir Emeka's endorsement of the whole effort. So In every case when we've eliminated any worm in other places around the world, we've had the local community get involved. Sometimes it takes us 10 or 15 years to get all the communities involved. But I think in this case, with Sarah Mecca's involvement, that 10 or 15 years will be abbreviated dramatically and get rid of it much quicker than it would have otherwise. Not even talking about his financial contributions, I'm talking about his personal commitment to the problem.
Mr. Carter explained that in the past, a big challenge in eradicating the disease is cutting through the red tape to gain access to the drugs needed to fight the disease. They hope to overcome this obstacle. This is VOA.
Trending on the web, it's action, reaction.
Some very talented celebrities are also apparently very smart. Mindy Kaling, who starred in the American TV show The Office, graduated from Dartmouth College. She jokes she went to Ivy League to, quote, pursue her love of white people and North Face parkas. Another comedian with brains, Rashida Jones. She graduated from Harvard in 1997, and not only did she get her degree in acting, she wrote scores for the infamous Hasty Pudding Club. Among Harvard's other prestigious graduates are Oscar winner Natalie Portman and late-night TV funny man Conan O'Brien.
Good morning and congratulations to the Dartmouth class of 2011.
Conan edited the Harvard Lampoon.
I must point out that behind me sits a highly admired president of the United States and decorated war hero, while I, a cable television talk show host, has been chosen to stand here and impart wisdom.
For VOA's Action Reaction, I'm Lisa Vora.
This is VOA's International Edition, and now it's time for a little something from our music department. Here's VOA's David Byrd.
She won the very first American Idol, and now Kelly Clarkson has a new song that's climbing the charts. It's called Invincible. It's from her new CD, Piece by Piece, and Larry London joins me to talk about this tune. Larry,
well,
this is another anthem from Kelly Clarkson, I guess.
She's very good at creating music that people can relate to and connect with, and that's one of the keys to her success over the years. And the new album is great, Piece by Piece. She took an off-road for a little bit, did some country music, but she's kind of back in the main lane of the pop world and just finished off with a Heartbeat song, which was her 16th Top 40 single. And so the new song, Invincible, as you mentioned, It's an inspirational song. It's a very happy, positive song. And Kelly's in a very positive place right now, despite all of the criticism that she's been undergoing recently because of her weight gain. And so she's okay. She's happy with herself. She says, I love myself, and I am invincible, which is what this song kind of reflects and represents.
You know I was broke down. I hit the ground. I was crying now. I couldn't make no sound. No one hears the silent tears collected. You know I had lost hope. I was all alone. Never been so low till you came along. Teacher, I feel the dots connected.
Now, she had a baby, right? That's
yeah.
Why she had some weight gain.
Well, she's always battled weight. That's been a problem that she's dealt with her entire life. She admits openly that the weight issues have always been troublesome for her. She did drop a few pounds a number of years ago, but since the baby, since the birth of River Rose, it has not been a very easy thing for her to get rid of the weight. But she's happy with herself, as she said. In fact, she said after she finishes her current tour, she's going to try and get pregnant again. She wants to have another baby by the end of this year. She wants to be pregnant.
And this song talks about, you know, issues like overcoming abuse. The video for it has different women in different scenarios. One woman is in a wheelchair. One woman is, like, in an abusive situation, you know, and it's different ethnicities, different races, et cetera. And is Kelly trying to broaden her appeal with the video, or what exactly is she doing there?
Well, that's an interesting question, David. Kelly, you know, currently appeals to quite a diverse group of people to begin with. They all like her and relate to her. She's a person who's overcome a number of obstacles, as we mentioned a little while ago. She grew up in a very small town in Texas, and they weren't very wealthy. Mom was an English teacher. And so, you know, she's considers herself to be the average kind of person. She doesn't look at herself as a star. She thinks her music is very relatable, and she's very reachable. She's very reachable. She's not kind of up on a perch or anything like that. She wants to be an everybody's person, and I think she comes across that way. You really like Kelly. She's genuine with everything she does. 25 million sales. She's won so many awards, including 12 Billboard Music Awards. So, you know, she's got the appeal that is necessary to make it in the music business these days. And the new song is doing very well. She performed it for the first time on television at the Billboard Award Show.
All right, that's VOA's Larry London. We'd love to hear what you think about this. You can go on to our Facebook page. That's VOA Music. It's facebook.com/VOA-music. You can leave your comments there. Larry also hosts VOA's Border Crossings, which has its own Facebook page. You can contact him there. Maybe he'll play Kelly Clarkson's Invincible.
We'd love to do it.
Let me tell you somebody else who's invincible. It's a young man named Jordan Spieth. In sports news, the Masters champion added another chapter to golf's record books on Sunday with a victory by one shot at the U.S. Open. It was a wild final round any way you look at it. Spieth sank an 8-meter birdie on the 16th hole, then shrugged off a double bogey at the 17th before becoming just the sixth player in all of history to take the Masters and the U.S. Open trophy in the same year. 21-year-old Spieth posted a 5-under total of 275 as he became the youngest winner also of the U.S. Open since Bobby Jones did it. And guess when he did it? 1923. And it turns out that Dustin Johnson, seeking his first major crown, had to settle for a share of second place in South African Louis Oosthuizen. That's right. Yeah, something like that. Birdied at 6-under the last 7 holes. Anyway, he finished with a 67. Worked out, I guess. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder that we have some great people on the other side of the glass. They are our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Chaz Hall. Give them a big high five. I'm Steve Norman in Washington, and have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The terrorist group Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, also known as ISIL or Daesh, has been engaged in the destruction and theft of some of the world's most important heritage sites and antiquities, dating back thousands of years. In late May, ISIL occupied the town of Tadmor, Syria, and the huge ruins of one of the great sites of the ancient world, the classical city of Palmyra. As part of its violent rampage through Syria and Iraq, ISIL has targeted for demolition sites of religious and cultural significance. Propaganda videos produced by the group depict its followers blowing up an ancient Assyrian palace at Nimrud, smashing statues at the Mosul Museum, and destroying the mosque of Nebi Yunus, which housed the tomb of Jonah, a place sacred to Muslims, Christians, and Jews. They are destroying and looting irreplaceable cultural property in order to intimidate and humiliate populations, and looted artifacts have become a significant source of income for terrorist groups, wrote Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs Sheba Crocker in a recent blog post. This is not just a cultural tragedy, said UNESCO's Director General Irina Bokova. It's also a security issue, with terrorists using the destruction of heritage as a weapon of war, an instrument of propaganda and destabilization, and as a means of financing their operations. The United States strongly supports UNSC Resolution 2199, which condemns the wanton destruction of cultural heritage in Iraq and Syria. It also reaffirms an existing ban on the sale of Iraqi antiquities illegally removed from the country and requires all member states to take additional appropriate steps to prohibit the smuggling of Syrian antiquities. Along these lines, the U.S. State Department recently funded the reissue of the Emergency Red List of Iraqi Cultural Objects at Risk to alert the public to types of antiquities most at risk of smuggling and trafficking, and co-hosted with UNESCO a roundtable discussion on this issue moderated by Assistant Secretary of State Evan Ryan. We also call on all UN member nations to start enforcing UNESCO's 1970 flagship convention aimed at prohibiting the illicit trade in cultural property. 128 of the 195 member states have signed the convention, but only some, like the U.S., Switzerland, and U.K., implement it through national legislation. The United States and UNESCO are leading the efforts to protect antiquities, monuments, and sites that hold universal value for mankind, wrote Assistant Secretary Crocker. For both the United States and the UN, preserving diverse cultural heritage is a critical step toward reconstruction, reconciliation, and building civil society.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.